She was the youngest person to participate in the 1965 Voting Rights March, walking from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, and she joins us this hour of the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen. We're joined by Linda Blackman Lowry. At the age of 15, she was deeply committed to civil rights issues. She had already been jailed 9 times. Her memoir is for young adults. It's titled Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. And she's here in Wisconsin for some public events. Linda, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you, Kate. Well, I'm glad to be here.
Take us on this 55-mile journey from Selma to Montgomery. Engage your senses for us. What was it like? What were you seeing around you? What was going on in your head?
Before I take you on that journey with me, I feel the need to let you know why I was even on that journey and what made me want to go on that journey. See, my journey started 7 years before when my mother died. She died at, I was 7 years old when my mother died, and I was born and raised in a segregated society. And the older people said that she wouldn't have died if she hadn't been colored, meaning in my 7-year-old mind, that if she hadn't been black, she could have gotten the blood she needed from the all-white hospital in Selma that was for white people only. So what racism, segregation did to me and my family, to my 2 sisters, my brother, my father, my grandmother, was, you know, hurt us. It tore us up, but we were still together. So when I was 7 years old, I vowed that when I got big, I was going to change things, that nobody would ever have to grow up without a mommy again because of the color of her skin. I was going to change that. And at the age of 13, I first heard Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. speak. And he said in that speech, he was talking about the right to vote and nonviolence. He said in that speech that you can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation. And I heard that at 13. And the second time he said it in that speech, I specifically heard him say, Linda, you can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation. So I knew, and I even jumped up saying, oh, that's how I'm going to do it. And my grandmother pulled me down. Nobody knew what I was talking about, but I knew. And that's why I got involved in that movement, a movement of nonviolence, so I could help bring about change. And that's how I ended up going to jail 9 times, marching for what I believed in, being beaten on March 7th and on the Edmund Pettus Bridge at age 14, receiving 7 stitches over my right eye, and 28 in the back of my head. I still have those scars. That's why I got involved, and that's why I marched from Selma to Montgomery.
And you're talking about Bloody Sunday there in March 1965. There were these repeated attempts to call attention to voting rights with walks from Selma to Montgomery. You were at the Edmund Pettus Bridge when state and local lawmen attacked the marchers with billy clubs, with tear gas, driving them back to Selma. And in your words, you said, when we got to the top of the Edmund Pettus Bridge going out of town, all I could see was a sea of white people. And that's when I got nervous. You said there were white men on foot and on horseback, state troopers and deputies. Along the road, there were white people sitting in their cars waving Confederate flags. What was this like to be in the throes of Bloody Sunday?
It made me nervous, as I said. But the thing about it, when we marched in numbers. We had never been attacked or brutally beaten or hurt before. So it just made me nervous. I wasn't really scared. I was just nervous. Besides that, it was hundreds of us marching, and it was old and young. So I didn't think, I was just nervous, but had this little bad feeling. I did not think that we would be beaten and the violence would be so brutal when the state troopers went to disperse us. They said it would be no marching from Selma to Montgomery, that we were to disperse. We had 3 minutes to disperse and go back to our homes or churches. Hmm. Well, the next thing you heard was troopers advance. But when I heard that, we were on our knees, because when we would go to a place, march to a place, and turn around or wasn't put in jail, we would always kneel, pray, turn back, go back to, you know, our churches and regroup or rethink the situation. Hmm. So that's what we were doing. I was in the 19th row from the front, and we was marching two abreast. So I know people from about the 17th row, and all the people behind me were on their knees. And that's when the state troopers advanced. They advanced with tear gas, and then, you know, with their gas masks on, they came in and just was beating and hitting everybody. And the sheriff, deputies, and his posse, the men on horseback, they were more brutal because they had made their say, billy club to beat heads. They looked like little baseball bats, and they were more vicious than to me than the state troopers. I ended up with 35 stitches in my head, and it came from a sheriff's deputy.
Did you have any idea at the time that you were making history, that your demonstrations and your marches would create actual change?
I didn't think about it as making history, no. I thought about it as making change and that I was helping to change things. And what was wrong was, to me, that black folks could not get help medically when they needed, or they couldn't go and register to vote. But history, never thought about making history.
We're talking with Linda Blackman Lowrie. She is the author of a new book for young adults, Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom. It's her memoir, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. Linda, what was it like for you when the voting rights were passed and you saw that what had happened worked, that all your demonstrations and calling attention to voting rights was making a difference when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law?
When on August 6, 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was signed by President Johnson, I I knew then that our parents and the people that could vote was going to go out and make a difference. And I knew then when I become of age, you know, I was going to vote myself. But I was elated because we had started something. My grandmother always said, when you start something, be determined to finish it. Be determined to bring it to the end and finish it. And I had started something with others, and we had finished. So that was just amazing to me in itself.
What was the hardest part of being a young teenage girl in 1965 and joining with adults to draw attention to racism, to draw attention to segregation, to draw attention to what your mother went through in trying to get her medical help, all in this effort for demonstrating and marching? What was it like for a teenage girl like you?
I think the hardest part of growing up during that time was, like you said, losing my mother and thinking that she would have lived if she hadn't been colored, not thinking what I was being taught, that, you know, when God gets ready for you, you're going to go to another place. But just being under a system of oppression. My father, to me, and this is an example, and I'm going to use the words, my father, to me, was the biggest, smartest, handsomest black man you ever wanted to see. And as a little girl, he took me to the store one day to buy some shoes. And my father parked his car, and we got out of the car, and we were walking hand in hand, just swinging hands and talking, and he was laughing, and he had his hat on, and his shoulders were squared, and, you know, he was just the jolly black giant. And we go into this store, and I see my father, hat comes off, hair goes down, shoulders go in, and a child younger than me would ask him, "What you want, nigger?" And him squeezing my hand, squeezing it, so maybe I wouldn't say anything. But I've seen that happen. And that word, there's no political correct way, you know, to say the N word. The word is nigger. It means ownership. Things like that I grew up on, and things like that are the things that hurt me as a child.
We're talking with Linda Blackman Lowry this hour. Her illustrated memoir for young adults is titled Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. And we want to hear from you. What do you remember from the civil rights demonstrations in 1965? Did you march? Where did you demonstrate? Do you have questions for Linda about what it was like to be a teenager in these marches? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment and hopefully hear from you on the Ideas Network.
Before I be a slave, I'll be.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn today. We're continuing our conversation with Linda Blackman-Lowry. She turned 15 as she participated in the Voting Rights March of 1965. She walked from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama to demand the right to vote for African Americans. She's in Wisconsin today and tomorrow for a lecture and a book signing tonight from 6:30 to 7:30. She'll be at the Center for Civic Engagement Building at UW-Marathon County. And tomorrow she'll be at Edgar High School Auditorium at the same time. Both events are free and open to the public. And right now you can join in the discussion with Linda Blackman-Lowry at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Selma Voting Rights March? Do you remember where you were during this period of civil rights demonstrations? Join in at 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Linda, the songs, freedom songs, as we were heading into the break there, they were so popular during the demonstrations of the 1960s. Tell us about the role music played in the civil rights movement, and also if you could indulge us to sing us a few lines of your favorite song.
The role of music was what kept us going. When we started going to jail, and I must say, yes, I went to jail 9 times. I'm a happy jailbird, but I'm a happy jailbird because I didn't go to jail for hurting anyone, taking anything from anyone, doing any harm to anyone. I went to jail for what I believed in, and I am happy that I can say I believed in something that brought about change to other people and is still helping people today. The songs were what kept us together. And my at the school I just left earlier today, I was telling kids how the music, not only did it keep us together, but we used to take church hymns and change words in them to fit any specific time. And there's one song that was a church hymn that said, we shall not be moved. We shall not. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's planted by the waters. We shall not be moved. And then we had a governor named George Wallace. And now George would stand in the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama and say, segregation now, segregation forever. And we would sing songs about George Wallace, like, Wallace is our enemy, he must be removed. Wallace is our enemy, he must be removed, just like a can of garbage in the alley. He must be removed. And the music just kept us going. But through any protest, any, to me, nonviolent fight, because fights in order to win has to be nonviolent. The music is something that just rekindles your spirit and keep you out there wanting to do whatever it is, whatever positive thing you are doing.
It binds people together.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. Radley from Minocqua. Hi, Radley.
Hi, thanks for having me on. So beautiful listening to you speak and talk. I like the idea of George Wallace being thrown away like a can of garbage. I was calling just because I was born in the 70s and grew up in the Kenwood neighborhood of Chicago Southside. And so growing up, I had a very, now I live in northern Wisconsin where it's extremely white, but back then, half my friends were black and lots of other different color friends. And, you know, I always thought of the civil rights as something that my black friends deserved and black people certainly deserve. But it's, as I've grown older, my view changed to more of a, less of a humanitarian perspective that justice is what everybody deserves, to say, you know, why wouldn't you want to open society to all different people for the good of society, not just the humanitarian good of the people who are being persecuted? But when I think of all the wonderful minds that now have the freedom to contribute to our society in so many ways, whether it be science or culture or education, I'm so thankful for the work that those people did before us, the people did before us, that you did, Ms. Lowry. So I just want to thank you for standing up, because it's good for everybody. It wasn't just something that was done for black people. It was something that was done for our whole country and our whole world, and it's so important. So thanks. It's just a different perspective, I guess, than freedom that somebody deserved, but it's really freedom for all of us to share in the great intelligence of mankind.
Yeah, and Linda, you're addressing kids today who have lived very different lives than you, who didn't grow up in the civil rights era. How are you able to connect with them and tell them that what their actions today represent continues the work you did so many years ago?
I don't tell them what their actions today represent, but is a continuation of work that we did, because children are very violent today, and we were very nonviolent. I can't put those two together, so I won't stand up there and lie to them. However, I do tell them that as a seven-year-old, I had a dream that I was going to change something. I made it up in my mind that that was what I was going to do, and that's what I went out to do. I had a desire. I had the determination. I wanted this changed, and I found the right connection when I heard Dr. King speak and him talk about steady, loving confrontation. Those three words told me that I could change stuff. When I talk to kids today, I let them know that they too can affect change, but I do not in any way connect what people are doing today to what we did then to bring about change, because they can't. It won't work. I am from the school of hard knocks, the old school. Nonviolence brought about not only a national change, it didn't just change the voting rights for black people in the South. It changed voting rights for women and everybody all over the country. But see, when we were doing that, when we were walking, we had no idea, I know I didn't, that this would be historical, that it would help the people outside of Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, which was the three most racist states in the world. But I had no idea. But when I talk to children now, I let them know that they are capable of bringing about change with steady, loving confrontation, and that they need to be consistent when they start something. If you start something, be determined to carry it to the end. I can't just, Children are kind of angry and violent now. And they say, when they're marching, they say, well, what they did back then, meaning a nonviolent movement, was what they did back then. But if you listen closely to some words in the song Glory, that Common and John Legend did from the movie Selma. Common says, you need the wisdom of the elderly and the energy of the young. And I believe that you can take that wisdom, because you younger people are smarter than we ever were. But they have the knowledge, but they don't know how to connect it together to make it work.
Radley, thank you so much for your call at 800-642-1234. Let's now go to Candy in Milwaukee. Hi, Candy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've never called before. First, I have to say to you, I have so much admiration for you over what you have been through, what you have done, what you're continuing to do, and educating the young people and the wisdom that you have. I think it's just marvelous, and I'm so happy to hear the show. And I'm from Milwaukee, and I was raised here. And during the 60s, I was a teenager. And I remember my sister and I coming home from school, seeing our mother just sobbing in front of the TV. She was watching what was happening in Selma with the dogs and the fire hoses and all of that. And she was just sobbing. And she, at that time, too, was involved in civil rights movement, Father Grappi of Milwaukee, who was leading it. And just, you know, being raised that way, it's just, you know, I have such gratefulness. We went on a trip to Florida when I was 10, and we just, you know, all the way down there, we saw slums, and, you know, and then went to Chattanooga Mountain, and it was beautiful. And I said to my mother, little girl, I need to go to the bathroom. And I looked and turned, and there was one that said white and one that said colored. And I said, well, I want to go in the colored one, because I said, I want to see colors. And, you know, it was just, you know, and she explained to me and how terrible that was, and that mother would have to, you know, couldn't take her girl into just the bathroom for everybody, and, you know. And so the impression she made on me and who I am and who my son is and my family, and, you know, it's just, I'm so grateful if more people could just raise their children this way. I think we'd have such a better world. And thank you for, like I said, for all you do.
Oh, thank you. Part of it was really comical, because when you said the black and the white restaurant rooms, my sister, my baby sister, Joanne, she wanted to drink out of that white-only water fountain so bad, because she actually thought that it had maybe Sprite or something in it. It couldn't just be water, right? So when the signs came down and Joanne was able to drink the water from that water fountain, we laugh about it to this day. She say, with her eyes real big, like in wonder, it's just water. And when you said you wanted to see the colors, because the bathroom sign said colored only, that made me think of Joanne. And thank you for sharing your story with me.
Well, Linda Blackman Lowry, let's go back to the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And at the Edmund Pettus Bridge on March 7th, 2015, President Barack Obama led a march. Let's take a listen.
We do a disservice to the cause of justice by intimating that bias and discrimination are immutable, that racial division is inherent in America. If you think nothing's changed in the past 50 years, ask somebody who lived through the Selma or Chicago or Los Angeles of the 1950s. Ask the female CEO who once might have been assigned to the secretarial pool if nothing's changed. Ask your gay friend if it's easier to be out and proud in America now than it was 30 years ago. To deny this progress, this hard-won progress, our progress, would be to rob us of our own agency, our own capacity, our responsibility to do what we can to make America better.
Of course, the more common. And what do you remember from President Obama's speech from that day?
I don't remember a whole lot of his speech. What I remember from President Obama that day is that before he shook the governor of the state's hand or the mayor or the senator's or anybody's hand, this man shook my hand, hugged me, and thanked me for what I had done. He looked at my scars and felt my knot on my head. And then he came out and made his speech. I was still up there on cloud 23. I don't know what I heard of that speech. I don't remember anything, but I do know that I have this picture with Congressman John Lewis in front of me and Mrs. Michelle Obama behind me with her hands on my shoulders and the president behind her with his hands on her shoulders. And I do remember that when they, on the White House blog, when they were talking about Selma and their visit to Selma, she said she had met this woman who was beaten on the bridge at 14 years old. And they had seen my scars. And I got all over Facebook going, "That's me, y'all. That's me she's talking about." And then a couple of days later, I saw her on the Ellen DeGeneres show. And Ellen asked her about their Selma visit. And she again said, "I met this woman who was beaten on the bridge at 14. And she said on the White House blog and on Ellen's show that she had wondered when she met me because Sasha Malia was 14 at that time. I think it was Sasha. And she wondered if she would have had her child there being beaten. So that's what I remember about March 7th, 2015.
Yeah.
And see, I did not walk across the bridge with him on that day because, and I said, I'm not doing it. I did not go across the bridge and get beaten on March 7th, a Saturday. I walked across that bridge and got beaten on a Sunday, so the only time I will walk across the bridge is on a Sunday.
We're talking with Linda Blackman Lowry right now. At age 15, she was the youngest person to march all the way from Selma to Montgomery, and she wrote an illustrated memoir about this time in her life for young adults. It's titled Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post your thoughts about the civil rights movement, your remembrances, on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're continuing our conversation now with Linda Blackman Lowry. At age 15, she was the youngest person to march all the way from Selma to Montgomery. Her new book is Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. She's in Wisconsin today and tomorrow for a book talk and a signing. Linda, you live in Selma today. What is life like there, and why did you decide to move back to Selma?
Selma is home, and there's no place like home ever. My husband was stationed close to Selma, and the first time he had been stationed in Alabama. But I had always said that I'm going to leave Selma, I'm going to get a college education, and I'm going to come back to Selma and run for mayor. I came back to Selma, and I ran for city council in a field of 5 men and 1 female. I said, you have seen the rest, now look at the best. And that was me. But I was in a runoff election for that seat, and I lost by 76 votes. Mm. And I said, okay, I know what God has for me to do. He wants me to let everybody know that if things did not go as they said it would, that I would advocate for any and everybody in general. So that's what I do. Moving back home to Selma, or going home, was a no-brainer. You know, I didn't leave home not to return, because you're always welcome at home. Hmm. It took Selma 36 years from the from 1965, from during that time, to elect a black mayor. And the theme was, Joe gotta go. Joseph Smitherman was the man that referred to Dr. King on national television as Martin Luther King. And he was there for 36 years. And I found out in 1988 how come he still stayed there. In 1988, I worked on Cleophas Mann, a black young man running for mayor. I worked on his campaign. And I worked the absentee ballots. So when I'm looking at the absentee ballots' names, and I see my father's name, and my father had died on May 2nd, 1972. But here I was in December of 1988. I questioned absentee ballots, and as I kept on looking, I saw about 15 to 20 people that was dead and had died during my childhood and young adulthood. So I know how he was getting reelected. And I started working to change the absentee ballot thing and proof of who's voting, because people would just go out to the cemetery and write down people's birth date and name and whatever else they needed and then vote for them. So, but things didn't change in 1988. It kept going until 2000 when Selma elected James Perkins Jr. as mayor. Reverend Perkins won, hands down, the white mayor. The theme was, Joe gotta go. Joe left. He said, Joe's gone. You want him out, I'm gone? Because the totals had shown, even without an absentee ballot counted, that Reverend Perkins had won mayoral election in Selma, Alabama.
Let's take a call now here. Patty, okay, from Exland. Hi, Patty.
Hello.
What would you like to add?
I just wanted to add a comment. I was listening to a couple calls earlier the lady who was talking about how she wanted to go to a black restroom and she wasn't able to. And then that brought back a memory to me. I was born in Montgomery, Alabama, and my dad nor my mom were prejudiced. If someone that was black needed help, I remember one time we were on a train and this black lady needed milk for her baby. And my dad got off the train, got the milk, and took care of it and gave it to the lady. And because he says that God loves everybody. But the reason I called was because one time we got on the bus in Montgomery, and I must have been about 7 years old or something, and I wanted to sit in the back of the bus. That's all there was to it, and I threw a fit. And my mom says, oh, my goodness, no, you can't sit back there. And I go, I want to sit back there. I want to look out the back window. And she goes, no, no, no. Finally, we got off the bus, you know, because I wasn't calming down. But, of course, I didn't realize the reason I couldn't sit back there. I just knew I wanted to sit back there. But the thing is that I have a lot of respect for Martin Luther King and the way he did things. He did not do it with hate. He did it with love. And I respect that man so much. It's just amazing. And, of course, he wasn't a perfect man, but I tell you what, he was a very good, good man. And he did a lot for the black people, just as you have. And I just wanted to say thank you. And that is correct. Not only did you help the black population, but you helped the white. And also some of the people who were so prejudiced, they didn't know why they were prejudiced. They just knew you were black, and that's it. And I've always been amazed with that, since none of us have a choice on what color we're going to be when we get born.
True. And thank you for those nice comments. However, I am at the point in my life, I am now 66 years old, I do not see any color. I do not have a white friend or an Asian friend or a Muslim friend, but I do have, say, a white friend named Emily. I see nothing but names, hearts, and their actions. I don't see any nationality, race, creed, no color. And I thank God every day that my journey in life has gotten me to this point. I can honestly say that at 7 years old, I hated white people. White people hated me. I sat straddled the racist fence. I did at 7 years old until I was 14. I did not like anybody white. They didn't like me. They, in fact, hated me. But then when people were coming to Selma, there was this young lady from London, Ontario, Canada, that came. She was a medical student, and she put her life on hold because she had seen an inhumane injustice. She had seen old, young boys, girls, men, women get beat on a bridge that were just walking and singing. And her name was Lynn, and Lynn had this book, this journal or something, and it said it had an article about hatred, about racism, and racism being hatred from one group of people onto another. And they were talking about how hatred caused all these physical illnesses. And the one I remembered was headaches. And at 7 to about 20s, in my 20s, I had these headaches, migraines nearly every other day. And I had to read that over and over because it said when you hate somebody, it does more harm to you than it might do to them. But to paraphrase it, it said, just think how you feel hating somebody. Think how the person that is being hated might feel. I tried that day to put that whole thing out of my mind because I was comfortable where I was in my so-called hate.
You had found your peace.
Mm-hmm.
You had found your peace.
Yes, but yeah. I was at 14, I was at peace. I hated, they hated me. Why not hate them back?
I want to ask you, Linda Blackman Lowry, in recent years, Black Lives Matter movement, it's emerged as a really powerful force calling for equality and justice. Do you see any parallels to the movement in recent years, Black Lives Matter, to what was happening in your era of the civil rights movement?
Black Lives Matter is a good movement, but they aren't consistent. I don't see the consistency. You need to change anything. At first, when Black Lives Matter first came out, there was, you would see them every time somebody got killed. In whatever city they got killed in, people would rally there and Black Lives Matter. But to me, after CNN stopped filming 2 weeks later, Black lives didn't matter. You didn't see the people out there. You didn't hear anything from them. And maybe I'm not.
Are you still there, Linda? Well, I think we lost her for a moment here. Let's go to now Kate in Holman. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I know you're running short on time. I wanted to just say that in 1968, as a white woman, I went to school in Chicago and was very involved with the movements. I volunteered at Operation Breadbasket. And in doing so, every Saturday morning, I would get a talk from Jesse Jackson and Dr. King. And I was surrounded by African Americans who shouted at that time, "I'm black and I'm proud." And I remember being embraced by the people sitting on both sides of me as this young white girl in her 20s. And they said, "Yell with me, I'm black and I'm proud." And I did. The reason I called, though, is that it changed me because it gave me the opportunity to be a minority. My first job after that was I went on a Native American reservation, very few whites. It changed my mind about how I look at people. And I've always been so grateful to those 60s African Americans that embraced me. I thank you for this program. It brings back wonderful memories of what shaped me.
Well, and do you consider yourself changed today, Kate, in the same way? Has it carried through your adulthood, this change in you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I went to the Women's March. I noticed that in the beginning, there were not a lot of people of color that organized it. But when I went there, I saw a lot of people of color. In my own hometown, I live in Holman, which is north of La Crosse. La Crosse has a really pretty cool thing going on now to embrace Muslims. We had a shoulder-to-shoulder demonstration that I went to. It brought forward over 700 people in this tiny town to stand. I've raised my daughters the same way. Yeah.
I want to jump in here. Kate, thank you so much for your observations and your memories. And I'm sorry that we are out of time and we lost Linda Blackman-Lowry mid-thought there with technical issues. She's the author of Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. She's in Wisconsin today and tomorrow for a lecture and a book signing tonight from 6:30 to 7:30. She'll be at the Center for Civic Engagement Building at UW-Marathon County. Tomorrow she'll be at Edgar High School Auditorium at the same time. Both events are free and they're open to the public. Thanks to Scotty Myers, Colleen Duvall, and Lisa Nelbandian for producing this show. We had on-air production help from Judith Sears-Poisson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network.